Hi, this is Gregory Hall from Virtue Cider in lovely Fenville, Michigan, and you're listening to the Cider Chat.
And this is episode 22.
Going up.
Hello and welcome to a Cider Chat. This is Rhea Wincolor, your Cider MC. And this is a weekly podcast where we speak to cider makers and enthusiasts from around the world. And on this week's chat, we're speaking with Gregory Hall of Virtue Cider in Fenville, Michigan. And there'll be more on that chat in a moment. There's just always so much happening in Ciderville. On the CiderChat.com website, there is an events page, and you just do CiderChat/events, and you could get there. Just go to the main page, and you'll see it. And I have a listing of places around the world, and there's a lot happening. It's kind of like you could just be planning your entire vacation holidays any time of the year and find a cider-related event. And some of the big ones coming up in the UK right now will be happening in March. March 18th and 19th is the Winchester Real Ale and Cider Fest. The update about the Winchester Real Ale and Cider Fest, though, is that it is sold out, so you can't get any more tickets to it, and that just shows you how popular it is. But alas, do not worry, because on the following month, at the end of April, that's April 30th and May 1st, there are two festivals coming right up, and that's the Houghton Sausage and Cider Festival, and also the Ross Beer Fest and Cider. They're held on the same 2 days. So depending on what part of the country you're in, maybe you could get to one of those. And the cool thing about these different cider fests, and they often have beer too and food, it might even be camping that you could do, they're really affordable. It's under $7, I think, to go to the Ross Beer Fest and Cider. They're charging $5 for entry and a glass. And once you get in, I imagine it's pretty affordable too. So not a bad way to be traveling about. Then just across the English Channel, if you go into the Netherlands, fly into Amsterdam, you could go south, just take the train down to Rotterdam on April 30th and go to the Cider Festival, and that is being held in the Phoenix Food Factory. I've talked about that place a little bit. If you go to episode, 2, that's with Wouter Bills from Cider Cider. And it's just a beautiful place where they're going to have this festival right on the water. There's a lot happening, just sitting outside in the cool, beautiful air. And there's food there. There's a brewery right next door. Should be really exciting. So there's a link to that. Lots of great things. Then in the U.S., coming right up in Michigan, right at the end of April, April 22nd and 24th. I know that they're still looking for folks who want to come and help steward a competition. It is a Great Lakes International Cider and Perry Competition, which most folks know as Glint Cap. And if you want to get more on that, there's a link. Certainly, if you follow Eric West at Cider Guide, that's his Twitter feed, you would get updates there too, I'm sure. And that's a pretty cool event in terms of really learning about cider, judging, and getting your palate, well, more, I don't know, more fine-tuned, I guess I would say. Lots of stuff. Then in New York, there's going to be an event in June 11th. It's called Pour the Core, and core is C-O-R-E, you know, like an apple core, and that's going to be a 2-session tasting event, so that's in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is such a happening place for a locavore, you know, and that kind of foodie culture, really cool scene happening there for quite a while. So that's it for now. I'm just direct you again, just go to the Cider Chat events page. And if you have an event that you'd like to have listed on there, please send it my way. Just send it to Rhea at CiderChat.com. I do indeed. Every one of you who reach out to me via the Ciderville portals, whether it be Twitter or Facebook. Recently, just heard from Evan, and he made a recommendation to check out a South African cidery, and that's Clarins. And I thought that was really cool because I have yet to be to South Africa, and it is certainly on my list. How would I know that if it wasn't folks like you who say, Rhea, this is what's going on? I mean, that's certainly the way we got connected with Millstone Ciders and my ability to speak to Kurt Scheer. And that was just two episodes ago, just on all his barrel aging. And that connection is so heartfelt. I mean, that's what it's all about in Ciderville. There's a lot of heart, a lot of soul. When you make something with your hands and your mind in concert, and it comes out and it makes people smile and laugh, that's priceless. So we rely on each other and we get a little geeky, but at the same time, we know how to play well. Knowing how to play well means you stay well together, be it with your family or your friends. Play and doing that well, man, that could last you a lifetime. And I'm sure that we all kind of gravitate, hopefully, towards those people in our life who really keep us in that mindset. And sometimes you just have to search them out. So thank you. That's how we roll, right? Helping each other. And while I'm on that topic, I just want to say hi for some of the new Facebook likes. That's Patty, Kyle, and Jenny. Thank you really for connecting. That means a lot to me. You could find Cider Chat on Facebook. And then on Twitter, you could find me at Cider Chat. And I just recently saw something from Lisa out in Portland. Her Twitter feed is at Erin Lisa, and that's E-I-R-N-N. I'll put a link on the show notes. E-I-R-N-N Lisa. And she just kind of mentioned on Twitter and kind of caught my attention, you know, we're almost ready to launch our cider marketing business. So want to hear more about that, Lisa. That's really cool because certainly cider folks need that. You know, when you're an artist and you're making something, the last thing in the world you want to think about is marketing it. It's like a painter. You just want to work on your product. So this is all the ways that the community is so large and vast, is that in order to move forward and bring that final product to the table, it takes many hands and many hearts. So thank you all for all of that. Alrighty, well, let's move on to this chat with Gregory Hall of Virtue Cider. And again, Virtue Cider is based in Fenville, Michigan. Before we get into this chat, I want to give you just a little bit of background on Virtue Cider, because when I was speaking to Gregory, we weren't necessarily speaking about the actual techniques going on in Virtue. I had a keen interest to kind of get his sense of where he sees cider now in its place, certainly in the U.S. and its relationship to the world, and also the tips that he might be able to have to inspire cider makers on how you could brand yourself or what you should be working towards, both as an individual cidery and as a collective cider nation, that allows you to brand yourself and move your product forward so that maybe down the line you start a cidery and you want to sell it just as they did with Virtue Cider. So let me give you the background on this. In 1988, John Hall, Gregory's father, he founded the Chicago-based Goose Island Brewery, which really became like a showcase brewery in that the beers were fantastic. And so it always, always begins with good product. It's kind of like this podcast. If we didn't have great content, you wouldn't be listening. So why would that be any different with cider or beer? So he launched this brewery and they were producing, but sometimes success gives you the problem that says, hey, you're not producing a lot. And you could either make a decision to stay at one level and keep your production at that certain level, or you could say, you know, I want to really launch it further. And still they couldn't keep up. So in 2011, Goose Island Brewery was sold to Anheuser-Busch InBev. And that's a long name. Of course, everybody recognizes Anheuser-Busch, that's like Budweiser beer. Well, Anheuser-Busch is really, and InBev is a conglomerate now, and they actually just had another merger this past fall, the end of 2015, with SB Miller. Think about like Miller's beer company. And now it's like one giant conglomerate. And in turn, if you never think like you're not being noticed, well, that's not true at all, because they're pretty savvy folks. And they are certainly watching what's happening in the craft industry. So not only did they take ownership of Goose Island in 2011, they've also taken over ownership of other breweries. And for instance, Elysium out in Washington State. That just like shocked the craft beer community, because they never thought Elysium would sell their brewery. You kind of think, oh, we're going to stay in business forever. But that's not the reason why everybody gets into business. I mean, if you watch Shark Tank, it's all about having a business, creating your model, and then moving it on. And I could actually speak from experience on that. I've done a little bit of that myself, licensed my program. I wrote a curriculum on crisis intervention, and I licensed that to people. I mean, that's kind of a nice way to go, right? So that happened in 2011. It was sold for $38 million. That's kind of a good investment, wouldn't you say? I mean, when you're starting up a cidery, if you think, like, I might pass this on to my children, that might not happen that way. And maybe you don't even want to do that. So a year or so later, Gregory started Virtue Cider. And just a few years later after that, and we're talking 2011 to 2015, Virtue Cider, the majority share was sold to InBev, or AB InBev, as people call it. So there's a lot of different dealings going on there. And what that allowed Gregory and the folks at Virtue Cider to do is now have an amazing resource, because that allows your distribution channels that you can't even imagine having when you're a smaller cidery. And also, besides distribution, you have an amazing, well, lab system and resources at all different levels of the thinking cap that people have on their certain specialties. So I wanted to talk to him about kind of segueing on that and how you move your business from point A to point B if you're thinking about branding and what's important. And I thought he had some pretty interesting insights on that. Again, we didn't talk about necessarily the nuts and bolts of Virtue, but he gave some really great tips, I think, for cider makers anywhere, anyone who loves cider, to think about as you're moving forward in your work. Because at the end of the day, it is a business. And if you can't run that constructively, then you're not going to be able to maintain it. So enough of that background for now. I'll let Gregory speak for himself. So let's all grab a glass and join this chat.
The way people classically represent Michigan is like a mitten. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Like
the a mitten state.
A mitten, like with a left-handed mitten, right?
Right.
And so when you're vacationing, you're up at the top peninsula?
Nope. We were right across the lake from Chicago. So, you know, it's got a lot of names. The Fruit Belt. We are naming it the Cider Coast because there's so many apple trees up there and cider makers. There's a lot of, on the west coast of Michigan, between the Indiana border and really all the way up, you have a lot of, traditionally you've had a lot of resort communities. And the people from the east side of the state tend to go to the top of the state, and the people from Chicago and Louisville and St. Louis tend to go to the west side of the state. You've got beautiful sandy beaches.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Really beautiful state. The state itself has been really supportive for cider makers, hasn't it?
It has. It's been terrific, you know, and I think a lot of that has to do with some of the cider makers that have been in Michigan for a long time. Mm-hmm. Guys like Mike Beck,
who, Uncle John's cider.
Yeah, you know, and he's been a real leader in the cider community and helped integrate it with the wine community and the apple community. So having that early leadership was a huge boon to the state of Michigan.
Yeah, definitely. came into cider via beer.
That's right.
Is that the right? That might not be the right way to say it, though. You didn't really come via beer, but you were.
Oh, I think I completely came via beer. So, my father had the good sense to open Goose Island when I was a young man, and kind of guarantee me a job doing something.
Were you a troublemaking kid?
I was a little bit of a, not an extremely troublemaking kid, but certainly had my fun back then.
Yeah.
You know, my father was big into beer, his whole life. He traveled a lot for work, so everywhere he would go, he would get the local beer. That was just kind of his thing to do.
Yeah.
And then you come back to Chicago and there's no local beer.
All right.
But I just remember, even as a real young boy, going to the beer store with him, and it was what we would call a liquor store now, but for me it seemed like the beer store because I was unaware of what was held in all those other aisles, and looking at beer from other countries and how interesting that was.
Right. I'm actually really keenly interested in some of your, tips for cider makers at looking down the road, because your family with Goose Island and now with Virtue Cider, you've been able to basically brand a product and then it was bought by InBev. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, certainly with Goose, we sold the whole company back in 2011. And, that allowed me the time and the resources to start Virtue. And back in, at that time, 2011, 2012, the early days of Virtue, were still kind of the Stone Age of cider in the U.S. There were many people who, when I told them I was going to make cider, I got kind of two answers most of the time. One was, that's great, my kids love cider, I put a box with their lunch every day. And then the others were like, so cider beer, like, I don't know if you can do that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can make beer from apples. And I said, you actually can't make beer from apples, but you can make cider, and cider's been around likely longer than beer. It's good to see it coming back.
You've been able to segue businesses into this degree, and I think that would be really informative for Ciderville, just to kind of know how that's done, because that's really, in the kind of Shark Tank model, you build something, and then you could either be in it for the next 100 years with your family, or you could then move it on. So how does someone do that?
Well,
and get the attention of somebody like InBev.
Yeah. What we tried to do at Goose was a combination of things. One, we were very inspired by tradition. I spent a lot of time as a young brewer in Europe, in the major brewing cities of London and Brussels and Munich and Prague, and visited breweries as much as I can. They were all, busman holidays. Every time I had, 2 weeks off, I'd go to Europe and visit breweries.
Right.
And then once Goose got big enough, then, I started bringing other people with me and, taking work trips to visit other breweries rather than doing it on my own dime. And, I always felt like my education at the Siebel Institute was fantastic, and I learned a lot of the technical stuff, but I was never really inspired by that. What inspired me was visiting other breweries and having brewers talk about the traditions that they had there. And every brewery does stuff a little bit differently, and they all have kind of a rationale based on, experience and materials, etc., and why they do things the way they do them. So I took that, and then, I think what made Goose a little different was, what's the George Bernard Shaw quote? Some people look at things the way they are and ask why, and some people dream of things that have never been and ask why not. Like when we did Bourbon County Stout for the first time, aging beer in a bourbon barrel wasn't done. There was no rule that said you couldn't do it, mm-hmm. You know, other than BJCP and the silly, you know, categories of the Great American Beer Festival.
Self-imposed categories.
Here are the categories that you may enter.
Right.
So these are the only real categories. Right. It's like, who cares about that? Let's go make great beer, you know.
Yeah.
And then, as a cider maker, because that worked really well for me with beer, I did the same thing. So in 2011, I went over to England and France and toured as many places as I could. You know, went straight to the Royal Bath and West show, and Bill Bradshaw, who's here, recognized me. He's like, wait, are you an American brewer? And I'm like, you know, is it that? Do I have the full beard and jeans and, or actually probably shorts on and
baseball cap
and
maybe
plaid? And, you know, it's like I had the uniform on.
Right.
So he identified me out of the crowd pretty easily. And he kind of showed me around. So I made friends with him real quick, and that was great. And then he introduced me to Tom Oliver, and Tom very quickly became kind of my English cider mentor, you know.
Nice.
And he told me about what he did and what everybody, you know, who I should talk to and, mm-hmm. you know, who might not be as free with their process and stuff. And he got me involved with Peter Mitchell class and the and hang out with John Worrell, the apple grower. Mm-hmm. So I kind of learned from the people who had been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I went with my laundry list of questions that I was used to asking of breweries, most of which were fairly technical. I found out very quickly I was asking the wrong question, that traditional cider making is a multi-generational effort. And, you know, they sure as heck weren't measuring pH, you know, in 1830s or whatever when they started. So, you know, they just kind of know what to do.
So what was that for a civil, you know, graduate and brewer to come over to another country and find out, geez, you know, this is like something part of our body and soul, and you're going to have to feel this, dude. No.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, everybody talked a lot about the apples. And, you know, my question was, okay, which apples should I use? You know, what's the list of apples? What's the apple recipe? Because as a brewer, that's how you kind of, you know, produce your beer. You source your raw materials, you put them together in order, and you control the process, you know, more like a baker than a cook.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, everything's got to be, you know, the same ratios every time and the same temperature and the same mm-hmm. time, and then you get the same product as a result.
Right.
And whether you're buying your barley malt in November or March or June, you kind of expect it to be more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it right away with cider, it's completely not like that. You know, you buy your fruit and then it's different kind of every time,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
If you get it from the same orchard on September 15th and then 2 weeks later, you know, the apples are a little bit different.
That's right.
If you get it from the orchard, you know, a mile down the road, you know, even if you buy the exact same variety of apples, you know, they're different
mm-hmm.
because, you know, maybe you're buying apples off, 70-year-old trees instead of 30-year-old trees.
What do you do at Virtue? Where do you source your...
We buy fruit. So in the fall, we buy fruit from really the two counties of Allegan and Van Buren. So we get almost all of our fruit from our county and the neighbors, mostly from pretty small independent farms. And we get a lot of run-of-field stuff.
Mm.
And then we get some from a little further afield, but still in southwest Michigan, guys who have more kind of hobby farms, and they have a much wider variety. They'll have 50 or 60 varieties, and we just get that, press it.
So you're pressing it on site?
Yeah, we press it all on site. And then once we get to...
do you store it too a bit?
We don't have storage, but there's a lot of storage in Michigan. Michigan's about an 800 million pound market.
It's huge.
So there's a lot of storage available, and we've made great connections with people that have do a lot of the brokering and buy from a lot of farms, and that's worked to our benefit because then we can get stuff out of storage, first of the year through the mid to late spring.
Yeah. I kind of have this image of like these bins of apples there and Gregory walking out and picking the apple and saying, well, let's wait another day. Let's let it sweat a little bit. Do you
Absolutely.
That?
Especially in the fall, because
so
in the fall, everything's outside. And we will have, we'll start, the stuff starts trickling in. We're pressing it almost as quickly as it comes in. And then it just starts flowing in.
Right, right.
You know, by October, from October through early December, usually, we'll have a lot of apples out there. And we kind of decide what we're going to press based on a lot of it on kind of feel. We want it to start to soften up a little bit, be able to stick your thumb into the apple,
right?
And we get a little bit maybe less of a yield that way, but we feel like we get not only more developed flavor, but more flavor like European ciders, because they're using 100% drops. When I've talked to a lot of the people over there and, tell them that we're not allowed to use drops, they just think that's insane. How do you make cider with fresh apples?
So. Right. I just had the same conversation with Bill Bradshaw about that, the drops. And the difference is it's quite profound.
Yeah, yeah. You get two boxes of apples from the same farmer on the same day, same fruit, same age trees. And you press one week, and you press the next 2 weeks later, the juice is completely different. And I think that's something that, for me, is thrilling, because it's so different than beer.
Yeah.
The condition of the fruit is as important as what the variety of the fruit is. Mm-hmm. In a brewer's life, you get your raw materials and all that stuff is constant. And then your process from when you mash in until you're done with fermentation and you filter, that's where you control the beer. That's when you make the beer. And with cider, it's kind of completely the opposite. It's like a donut. The outside of the process is really where you control the cider. It's the apples that you get, the condition of the apples, and then, talking to a lot of English cider makers, French cider makers, you press it and they'll say, sometimes we press in September and the cider's ready in 2 weeks, and then we'll press, in October, November, and it's not ready for 4 months.
Right.
And that's kind of how we do it.
I really enjoyed the way that he described cider making as a donut, looking at the outside of the product. The condition of the apple or the fruit is as important as the variety of the fruit. And those are really important words to any cider maker to think about. It's all about the fruit. You hear it over and over again. And just to be fair, in the craft beer industry, what I've seen a bit more recently, due to that kind of locavore, that sustainable agricultural movement in the region of Ciderville that I'm in, is that we are seeing different terroir of even grain varieties that I've talked to some brewmasters who could actually define while they're tasting where that grain is coming from because it's grown so locally. So I think that there's a little bit of a uniqueness that we kind of do coattails on each other within craft libations, being it distilled spirits or craft beer or cider making. The more we see that local understanding of agriculture and that willingness to really dig deep into the soil and promote local sourcing of fruit, we're going to continually see this topic, of which he will be speaking even more deeply into that piece of terroir or providence and how he feels that's so important for cider makers. Cool stuff, right? So we're going to get back to this chat. But before we do, I want to take this moment to say, if you like what you are hearing on Cider Chat and you would like to sponsor this podcast, then please send me an email, Rhea@ciderchat.com, and we'll send you that media kit. Not only will you help get this podcast, which requires a lot of producing, hosting, and production work, but you'll also be helping the Cider Agenda move forward for all as we continue going out into the world speaking to amazing people within the cider trade. So, it's as easy as asking for the media kit, and I hope to hear from you soon. Meanwhile, let's get back to this chat with Gregory Hall from Virtue Cider in Fenville, Michigan.
In the fall, we do a first cider of the season, Cider Nouveau, every year. And that is the one cider that we make that is made without any barrel contact.
Mm-hmm.
So we just want to get, like, this season's fruit in and out.
Yeah.
That's a big release for us in November. This year, one of our other ciders, kind of our current flagship, is called Prince Hal.
Prince Hal.
Prince Hal.
Hal.
And Prince Hal is named for the young King Henry V. So, you know, if you are a student of Shakespeare at all, you know that Prince Hal was kind of the main character in King Henry IV. You know, that series of two plays, part one and two,
mm-hmm.
when his father was King Henry IV, and, you know, because his name was Henry II, he didn't go by Henry, he went by Hal,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and he was born in Wales,
mm-hmm.
and if he was born in Wales and spent time in Wales in the, you know, 15th century, undoubtedly he was drinking cider,
mm-hmm.
because they weren't, they certainly weren't growing malt and hops. And then according to Shakespeare, he had a little bit of a riotous youth, and kind of flandered about with a gentleman, and I use that term loosely, called Falstaff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they he kind of had not such a good reputation as a young man, but it was all kind of part of his plot to have people underestimate him so that he could, you know, one day be a great king, which mm-hmm. in fact he was. And, you know, he led the English into Agincourt and defeated the French when he was mm-hmm. vastly outnumbered, and did the famous, you know, Shakespeare speech, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers." So all that, I think, I just love that stuff.
I get that sense. You know, without ever even having had Virtue Cider, and I haven't at this point, my sense, I could kind of taste that English in, it's going to kind of come through, that traditional English style, the building, the Tudor representation. Oh, look at that. Jason just passed over the Elder Hall, and it's saying sparkling cider. Jason, your name is down there.
That's a different Jason. That is actually, we're in Portland right now, and that is a friend of ours who is in Portland, a chef named Jason French.
Yeah.
The only thing I like better than eating or drinking is eating and drinking. A meal with a fine meal with a fine drink
mm-hmm.
at its side. A night at the table is about my favorite way to spend mm-hmm. the night. With that, I meet a lot of friends in the culinary community. And back when I was a brewer, we used to do some collaborations with chefs. And we thought it'd be really fun to do collaborations with chefs in the cider world, too. And rather than have them come up and do kind of a pick apples, press apples type situation,
mm-hmm.
We thought it would be far more interesting for them and for us to have them come up and do a blend. So come and taste everything that's in our cellar, taste some of our barrels, and then decide which ones they like, and then spend a couple days,
mm-hmm.
You know, with the graduated cylinders and make a blend. So this is one that we made with Jason French in fall of 2014, and just bottled it and left it in the bottle for about 6 months, and then shipped it out here. It just landed in Portland on Monday.
Cheers.
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 And cheers to you, Ciderville. We were sipping on that Elder Hall, and you'll hear us further talk about it as we go on with this podcast. I just want to say that there was a couple of us in the room. That was Jason, who you might recognize him from a sound Opinions, and that is a podcast. It's like Chicago Public Media. It is supported by Goose Island Brewery. So isn't that sweet? That's a nice supporter for them. And just shows you how important it is to support these podcasts in that way. Anywho, Jason's a pretty cool guy. He was hanging out with Gregory, and now he's part of Virtue also. And we also had in the room, you didn't really hear her, but her name is Michelle Foyk, and she is spearheading that new cidery in Chicago, Iris. So I'm going to have a link onto that. That'll be opening soon. So cool stuff happening. I wish you were there. But if you are now with a cup in your hand, cheers to you. Let's get back to this chat.
You know, one of the things that makes our ciders kind of unique from ciders from other parts of the country and even the most English and French is we tend to be a little bit more balanced toward acid.
Interesting.
And I think
are you saying Virtue or
Virtue?
Okay, yes, because I don't
Virtue, and I think maybe typically Michigan ciders. You know, I think that's just the fruit we've got.
How do you manage the acid? Because that's something that I think really goes all over the map in the U.S.
Yeah.
And some of that is just really new cideries and kind of finding their way. But also some people really like a really high acid. And so I'm really curious about this. How do you approach the acid?
Well, you know, because we are making ciders for the table as much as for the bar, or if not more so, I'm kind of leaning on feedback I got as a brewer, talking to chefs in Chicago, and having them say, you know, I love your beer, I drink your beer, I come into Goose Island and drink it, and I've got it at home, but it just didn't go great with food. It doesn't go as well as wine does. And I said, well, what are you looking for? And he said, you're looking for more acid and less bitterness. That was about the time, maybe about 10 years ago, when we started playing around more with Belgian stuff at Goose. You know, when I made the transition to cider, you know, and I'm drinking all these ciders in England and France, and I'm getting, you know, acid in every glass to some respects. You know, that was the first thing I thought of. It was like all these chefs' voices in my ear saying more acid. Ciders comes complete with like five or six organic acids. You can just kind of build on that through controlling fermentation. I think if you lined up our cider versus maybe some others, you'd say theirs has a little more acid. You know, we think that's okay, and that's kind of a little bit defines Michigan cider. I don't know the science behind it yet, but we're kind of looking into that.
Well, that's a terroir that you're talking
absolutely.
About, right?
It's absolutely.
So exciting for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. You know, our fruit, you know, every time we press, we're measuring pH, and we measure it all the way through the process, and we'll soon be doing more titrations on a regular basis.
Bottle conditioned? The sparkle?
You know, right now we're not.
Would you have had this more sparkling than it is?
Yeah.
I think?
Yeah. A year from now, you'll probably see not all of our ciders, but a lot of our ciders and a lot of ciders across the country bump up in CO2. The potential of cider is without limit. Go out in that room and see all these cider makers, and everybody's making something different.
That's true.
You know, and more so than beer or wine. You know, I think there's more variety. You know, flavored ciders, it's not something we really play around with too much. But, you know, we were at this place, Cider Bite, little pub
in Portland.
In Portland,
yeah.
It had 20 or 24 ciders on tap, and all but two or three were flavored. You know, and that's just part of the cider game now. And, you know, beer hasn't gotten there yet. You know, wine, you know. If wine's flavored, it's called a wine cooler, and that's not necessarily the most sophisticated thing to call your drink.
You know what I find with the sparkling, with any kind of product, is it could really kind of mask the flavor. And so I agree with you. I think it's going to really blossom in a way, and people are going to be doing that a lot. But I also think that that pendulum will swing back a bit as people's palates become a little bit more sophisticated again. And that's kind of a very snobby term to use. But this is opening up differently, you know, just sitting here right now. I'm getting more depth. You know, the initial fizz has kind of evaporated that initial bottle, you know, flavor. And so I think if I talk to you 5 years from now, you'd say, you know, Rye, well, we have some, sparkling, and we're going more still, too.
Yeah, this sparkling, we bottled the same cider still, too.
Nice.
For him.
Nice.
Because we think that's a huge part of the future of cider. You know, and I think...
Is it still?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and what you were saying, you know, I don't think the problem is we need people to grow more sophisticated palates. I think there's plenty of sophisticated palates out there. They just haven't tried cider yet.
Yes, good point.
You know, and people that are drinking natural wine and orange wine, they are used to sophisticated flavors and, you know, many, many, many flavor spikes that just as you were saying, while drinking the Elder Hall, it tastes a little different every time you go back to it.
Yeah.
You know, and if we were having a meal, it would taste a little different with every bite.
Right.
And cider can do that. Cider can fill the same drinking occasions that many wines do.
Seems like a great Thanksgiving cider to me. You know, it's just a nice thing to put on the table and kind of really complement the turkey. And
here, if beer owns 4th of July, we think cider should own Thanksgiving.
In terms of the new cider makers coming up and people kind of looking at their future and setting a model, you have to have good cider. You have to have good product, right?
That's
undoubtable. But what should people be thinking as they're, because it's a business, going that business approach.
Right.
What worked for you? Was it having those connections? I mean, you had the Goose Island experience, so you certainly had those connections. But what else should young cider makers, because this is going to happen. And
well, you know, cider is very quickly reaching an accelerated growth rate that it took craft beer much longer to get to. The first thing is, let's look at wine, let's look at beer, and let's look at what wine has done right and wrong, and what, you know, beer has done right and wrong. In the long term, you know, and I look at wine and I say, okay, the French, you know, got it right like 300 years ago when they started defining style by geography. Because, you know, if you're in Bordeaux and you call your wine Bordeaux, you know, it forever limits your competition. And the California winemakers, they couldn't make Bordeaux, but they used the same fruit. So they started making Cabernet, and they started talking about Cabernet. And what they didn't count on was, you know, people growing Cabernet up in Washington and people growing Cabernet in Chile or South Africa or Australia. Mm-hmm. So now you go in a restaurant and you order a glass of Cabernet or a glass of Chardonnay. Not only do you not know what part of the country it comes from, you don't know what continent it comes from. So I think that they... you know, they didn't do, certainly wasn't a plan, but they commoditized grapes. So now that the grape is far less special than what it was. And I look at beer, and I think beer's kind of doing the same thing with styles like IPA. You know, if your lead brand is an IPA, and your drinker goes into the bar and orders, you know, their favorite IPA, you know, favorite brewery IPA, and they say, oh, we don't have that, but we have this IPA. 90% of the time, they're like, great.
You could be on the East Coast making a West Coast style IPA.
Right.
So how does that fit with cider then?
So I look at cider and say, you know, I think if we're smart collectively, we really talk about, you know, terroir and provenance, and we really say, you know, there's a difference between ciders from the Great Lakes and the Northeast and, you know, the Mid-Atlantic, you know, kind of Appalachian cider. And of course they're different.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be different?
Right.
You're insane to think they would be the same, you know.
Yeah.
And really play that up, you know. Nice. And you look at, like, again, if... all the value that's added in, like, the French wine market by being from a particular region, I think that's great. And I think it, you know, grants kind of incentive to the small independent cider maker who's using local fruit to be more special. And they can compete against a big national cider maker who's using, you know, juice or juice concentrate from who knows where. When I went to England, France, and then also Spain, there were three commonalities to making traditional, proper farmhouse cider. One was apples. Everybody talked about the apples they used and how they were using local apples and how their local apples were different or better than the others. Two was barrels. Everybody, like I said, is either 100% in barrels or has some barrel component. And that's just, you know, it's like wine in Burgundy, you know. Of course it's in a barrel. No one talks about their barrel-aged, you know, Burgundy. It's all in a barrel. That's what, that's the assumption. And then last is, you know, it's made at a cider house. You don't, are there breweries or wineries or factories that make cider in England, France, and Spain? Of course there are. But all the best stuff is coming from a cider house on a farm. And I think that because of the microflora and the you know, the difference in making beer in a nice sterile brewery where you've got a hot side and you can sanitize everything versus making cider on a farm where, you know, you never really truly sterilize the fruit. The microflora matters, and you're getting not only the microflora that came in from the orchard but the microflora on your farm. And if you're doing that at a factory in downtown, you're not going to get that. I think that's what gives, you know, traditional farmhouse cider some of its complexity and character. So that's what we're trying to do. Providence has returned, you know, it's kind of done this full circle of that's was really the only reason you bought something is because where it was from. That's where the values come in, you know, is where it comes from. And sourcing is becoming, again, so important. And we've got kind of got this maker culture again, which I think is fantastic.
Maker culture?
Maker culture. You know, it's kind of like if you go back to 500 years ago in Europe, you know, the trade guilds were like the most important organizations. You know, they weren't unions. They were guilds of skilled people. And you would buy something from someone in a guild because you knew, you know, that was kind of your editor. If he belonged to the, you know, whatever guild, you know, the cloth maker's guild, he was a great cloth maker. And the guy who didn't, you know, wouldn't charge as much.
Is that why you do cider maker two words? That kind of fits in a little bit in that descriptor, you know, as a maker guild. I mean,
we're both things, you know, as cider makers. We are, you know, we make cider, but we're also part of this kind of makers community, you know. Whether you're making, you know, jeans in Detroit, you know, or a handmade bicycle in Portland, you know.
But why would the other ones, like winemaking is one word, and brewmaster is one word, but we don't have that with cider. We really separate, like, cider master, cider maker, but brewing didn't do that. I think we have an opportunity in the U.S. to, like, kind of make
I think brewmaster comes because it was such a German thing, and, like, you know, most sentences have one word in German.
Really long.
They just keep adding more stuff to it.
That's the best answer I've heard yet for cider maker in terms of the two words. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, because I think we belong to two guilds, you know, that of cider and then that of the makers, the people who make stuff by hand. And that is clearly coming back strong.
And so this is our time in that way.
I think it is.
I really enjoyed what Gregory Hall had to say about cider maker, the makers, and the guilds. It really made sense to me. And it's truthful that that's kind of like the best definition I've heard for having it be two separate words. That's not to say that what one country does, the other country doesn't necessarily have to follow. And maybe the terroir of the U.S. is that people call it cider making a one word. I notice even in winemaking that it's two separate words and sometimes one word. So I guess there's confusion all around the map. Maybe the final word is just make good cider and enjoy it. Lots of pearls of cosmic wisdom there, especially at that piece around providence and terroir. I think that he really wrapped that up nicely. So thank you very much for spending time with us in Ciderville, Gregory. And thank you for that great bottle of the Elder Hall. I brought it back to my own little Ciderville, and it is being coveted and will be opened maybe at Thanksgiving. I don't think I'm going to wait that long, though. Oh, boy. So, folks, let's make sure that we thank the sponsor for this podcast episode, the folks at CiderCellars.com. And remember, that is cellars, as in the place that you keep your barrels of good tasting cider. They're importers of UK cider, so check them out at CiderCellars.com. And while you're online, how about dropping a review and rating for this podcast in iTunes or Stitcher? And now we can be found on the app TuneIn, which is a really cool program too. You could get a lot of great music and podcast stations at TuneIn. So there'll be a link in the show notes to all that and more from this week's chat with Gregory Hall at Virtue Cider. So until next week, this is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you soon in Ciderville. Go, go, go.